Inside has just turned 15, and celebrating a birthday means inviting a special guest.
I'm Jeffrey Callison. I was the first host of Insight.
That's right. Insight's original host, Jeffrey Callison, joined me in the studio to record an hour of memories and laughs. You'll hear us chat about the history and evolution of this program, and we'll answer some of the questions that we are often asked.
Is Insight live?
We'll revisit some of the deep and memorable moments on the show, and then we'll look ahead to what's coming next.
Yes, I have heard it.
Fifteen is a special birthday for Insight, and we've made a birthday special for you.
I'm Jeffrey Callison.
And I'm Beth Ruriak.
Join us for Insight.
From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. And with me in the studio today, a person you might remember.
I'm Jeffrey Callison, back to do a bit of celebrating.
It's great to have you back in the studio.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Jeffrey was the original host of Insight, so let's try this together.
Happy 15th
birthday
to Insight.
Insight. Fifteen years ago, on July 19th, 2004, Insight went on the air, becoming the first daily talk show in CAP radio history.
From KXJZ in Sacramento, I'm Jeffrey Callison.
Jeffrey Callison. He helped create the show. He's back in the studio today. And actually, you look really at home here, Jeffrey.
Well, I do feel kind of at home, which is nice. It's been 7.5 years since I've been here. And I feel more at home today than I did 15 years ago when we started Insight, because it was kind of nerve-wracking.
But how important was that day to the station, the day of the launch of the show?
Well, it was a big deal for several reasons. And one of them was it was really like the champagne bottle being broken on the hull of the good ship CAP Radio, because we used to be in this really primitive building in this little tiny office park. Literally, it looked like a dentist's office that a radio station was in. And so the parking garage that was below the floor, you could hear cars stopping and starting. Doing a live daily show like Insight was impossible in that building. Uh-huh. So we moved into this building here, and it's a real broadcast facility. So one of the overriding priorities when we moved here was to start finally our own live daily show. And so that's what Insight represented, the growth of the organization.
It started as an afternoon show, though, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. And that was partly because we weren't really sure how well the show would do. And the afternoon is kind of like a low point in radio. So we felt like if it didn't work out, then it wouldn't matter so much. So we started out in the afternoon. And as time went by, we moved sort of earlier and earlier. And now here you are at 9 o'clock, Beth.
Tell me about the topic of that first show. Do you remember it?
Oh, yes, I remember it quite vividly, because at that time, one of the most pressing topics in the Sacramento area was what was going to happen to the Sacramento Kings, who are still a lot closer to their glory days of the early 2000s.
Here's the beginning of that first Insight.
Arco Arena is probably the loudest and most fun place in America to watch a pro basketball game, but Arco is also old by NBA standards, that is, and seems like it's a long way from anywhere. There has been a lot of talk in recent months about building a new arena. There's no definite location and no consensus yet on who should pay and how much. We would spend the whole hour on one topic back then. So this first show was all about the Kings and a possible new arena. The Sacramento mayor at the time, Heather Fargo, had asked some people, including a developer named Tony Giannone, for recommendations for where to build a new arena.
And in looking at various locations, we decided to get for our city and for our population the best bang for the buck, that we would try to put it in a downtown location that would bring about a rebirth of our downtown area.
That was considered the crazy idea then, wasn't it?
It sure was. It seemed out of left field. I mean, I personally thought that myself, but I thought it was a provocative idea. And Tony Giannone, a very experienced guy, knew what he was talking about. So I thought he'd be a great guest on the first Insight.
Well, it is funny how life goes, because that discussion and then the battle to keep the Kings continued for years. So if we fast forward to October 4th, 2016, opening night of the new arena, it's been named the Golden One Center, and it ended up being built
at 7th and Key.
How about that?
They bulldozed Downtown Plaza, built the arena there, and it appears to me anyway to be a huge success. I actually walk through that site every day walking from on my way to work.
Yeah, that crazy idea ended up becoming a reality. Sir Paul McCartney was the first concert. Did you go that night?
I didn't go, but I'm actually a Golden One account holder. So we got in for free the morning that it opened. And it was just a stunning place to see. Even the food was just fantastic because it's not like typical arena fare. You can get all kinds of nice stuff. So it was very impressive. And it was just amazing to think back how long it had elapsed since the talk about the need for a new arena. And now that it's finally there.
Well, Paul McCartney picked up on it. He played and played and played that night, and he just didn't even want to stop. I do want to pull a little bit of sound from Sacramento City Council member Steve Hansen. He was on Insight on that day, October 4th, and he was talking about ways to get to the new arena. Now, the downtown area had been under construction for a number of months, and that was going to continue. So for people who planned to drive, there was also a new online parking pass system, thank you, technology, that had just been launched.
And in fact, I think we had over 80,000 reservations in the first 24 hours that was available. But also, whether it's walking, biking, taking transit, or car sharing, you know, we have so many choices for people to get to and from the Golden One Center that it's really a carefree approach that we've taken by trying to do so much planning.
Do you remember those debates about traffic and kind of gridlock might happen downtown?
Absolutely.
Well, they built it. The Kings stayed. Traffic has been manageable. There have been 2.5 years of big name concerts and events. And the story has shifted to the development and renovation of the broader downtown corridor, also to the impact, which, as you know, Jeffrey, includes some very serious challenges like rent and housing issues. Also, more people than ever before experiencing homelessness.
Yes. As I said, I often walk past that area, so I'm very much confronted by the homelessness. It's really jarring, actually, to see the spectacle of the new buildings and the arena and so on, but yet to see, frankly, so much poverty still in the downtown area. So this is all a work in progress. And as someone who continues to listen to Insight, I know that you still talk about all those issues and so much more here every day.
Do you recognize that voice? That is Insight's first host, Jeffrey Callison. We're in the studio together, marking the 15th birthday of the show. Jeffrey created and hosted Insight from its first day on the air in 2004 through December of 2011.
And then after I left, there were a few months of guest hosts. And you were one of them, I believe.
I first guest hosted in January of 2012.
And then you became the permanent host.
Yeah, that happened a few months later in April of that year. But there are other topics, as you know, that spanned your years and mine. And I'm thinking in particular of a time when Insight was actually a call-in show.
Let's take one more call before the next break. Nick from Nevada City, you're on the air.
We talk about all this fire prevention and how we want to suppress all these fires. Is that why we put out these little 5 to 10 acre fires? Because I know a lot of them sometimes are start by lightning strikes away from communities, but we still put them out. Why is that?
I think Ken Pimlott from CDF is the best person here.
The 5 and 10 acre fires we aggressively put out because the state's mission is to protect the resource and minimize costs. And through aggressive fire suppression, we are able to keep the cost of fire suppression at a minimum. We don't have the luxury on the state responsibility lands, on the private lands, to allow a fire to get big because of the threats that it poses to the resource, life safety, and property.
We did try this listener call-in format for a few weeks or even a couple of months in 2004. Frankly, I was never convinced by the idea, but it was just part of the original idea for the program. One of the problems for me about the listener call-in is that sometimes people call in with these great stories, and I'm thinking, who are you? Who is this person? Is this even true? Mm. And it also became such an unreliable and unpredictable part of the program that it just seemed better to build it up more robustly as a magazine-type program with guests that we had there. So that's why we moved on from listener call-ins. But to your point about topics, wildfires was a critical issue then, which has only become more deadly now.
We had years of stories on the drought and its worsening. And then the West started experiencing what we now call these mega fires in the year-round fire season. Let's listen to a clip from our show on November 8th, 2018. This is just a few hours into what would become the campfire. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Just a heads up that there are some mandatory evacuations in effect for a rural area of Butte County. There is a wildfire that has grown to about 1,000 acres, we're told. Of course, the weather's warm and it's very windy right now. An area around Paradise and the tiny town of, I should know this, is it Pulga? I think the little town there is being evacuated as well. CHP is closing some highways. So our news newsroom is on this. Stay alert in the area if that is where you are or where you're traveling through. I'm actually going to share a clip from the next day then, just 24, 25 hours later. Here's what the broadcast about the beginnings of the campfire sounded like. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. The campfire in Butte County has now ripped across more than 70,000 acres, with a reported thousands of structures having been burned. Isn't that something, Jeffrey?
It's just horrific to hear that transition there. And of course, it was by far the worst for the people in that area. But I do so vividly remember walking around downtown with this mask on my face, because for one day, I believe our air quality was worse than Beijing. It was just a horrific time.
Those clips also speak to something else that's happened with the show, and that is the response to breaking news. When we had the Oroville Dam crisis or other situations that have happened, the show now goes on the air outside of its 9 to 10 a.m. time slot, or expands as it needs to for political events, for different news coverage. But what I was getting to is that Chief Ken Pimlott, who you talked to in that call-in show, continued to be a familiar guest for us over the past years. I want to share one more clip. This is a few months actually before the campfire. It's August of 2018. The car fire was coming into containment, and there was a lot of conversation about money that was being spent on firefighting. When you compare what the budget is for firefighting in hundreds of millions versus the billions of dollars in damage that are happening, are we still vastly underfunded, Director Pimlott?
This whole effort, and it's not just the response, it's all of the efforts around the impacts of climate change in the state, are all things that we have to continue to invest in. To think that just a few years ago, we would invest $220 million from cap and trade funds just in forest health and fire prevention was unheard of. We continue to see significant support in getting this done. But yes, we're going to have a strong commitment, not just by government, by private sector folks, by partnerships, federal government, all of us together working to solve this challenge.
Chief Ken Pimlott was the director of CAL FIRE. He retired at the end of 2018. CAL FIRE's new director, Chief Tom Porter, has already joined us on the show. So among this scope of topics, Jeffrey, wildfires continue to be an ongoing priority for the newsroom.
Insight continues after a break. We're marking 15 years of Insight conversations. We're often asked about how we make this show.
Oh, yeah, those questions like, how do we pick topics and how do we find guests?
Yes, and how do we read all those books?
We're going to answer some of those questions in just a moment.
You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio.
Welcome back to Insight's birthday show on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak.
And I'm Jeffrey Callison.
Jeffrey's back with us as we mark 15 years of Insight and still going strong. Insight is a live daily show, 9 to 10 in the morning, Monday through Thursday, with three or four segments in the hour, depending on the topics.
The number of segments, the number of guests, and the depth of the conversation has a lot to do with the work and the research of the staff who make it possible.
We call it the Insight team, the hosts, the producers, the interns, the guest hosts, the digital team. our technical staff and our executive producer. So many people in the building touched this show. So we thought we'd say thanks to a few of the key people over the 15 years.
Yeah, I'm going to start with Carl Watanabe, who was the program director here. And he was the one who basically asked me to create the program in the first place. And then Benjamin Jonas Keeling, our first senior producer, Jen Picard, who came along soon after that. Also Robin Souza, Lynn Weaver, Natalie Breen, and Sossin Morar, who's now a reporter at the Sacramento Bee.
I'm going to add a few of the key producers from my era, James Morrison, Cody Drabble, Chris Remington. Also Nick Bruner and Paul Conley often help us. Jonathan Iestis, Bert Johnson, Kate Gonzalez, and recently Helen Barrington. Our executive producer is Joe Barr. And always, through all the years of this show,
our technical director, Mark Jones.
In fact, you're going to hear Mark in this montage of guest hosts, but you have to listen for the name Martin Jenkins.
I'm Mike Montgomery.
I'm Emil Guillermo.
I'm Donna Appadone, in for Jeffrey Callison.
I'm Douglas Everett.
I'm Rick Cushman.
I'm David Watts Barton.
I'm Beth Duncan, in for Beth Ruyak.
I'm Bruce Maimon.
I'm Pamela Wu.
I'm Cody Drabble, sitting in for Beth Ruyak.
I'm Leslie McClurg.
I'm Steve Milne.
I'm Ben Adler.
I'm senior producer Jen Picard.
I'm Alan Ray. In answer to your next question, Beth Ruyak will be back on Monday.
I'm Randall White.
I'm Paul Conley.
I'm Nick Bruner.
I'm Marianne Russ.
I'm Martin Jenkins, sitting in for Jeffrey Callison.
Wow, that blew my mind. Emil Guillermo, I'd forgotten about that.
Wasn't that great?
Yeah.
We really count on the guest hosts, and it's no easy task to jump into this chair. So thankfully, the production staff is so strong so that a guest host can step into what I call a very fast-moving river.
Absolutely.
But Jeffrey, I get a lot of questions from people about how this show is done, how we do what we do, and the whole picture of it. Did that happen to you too?
Oh, yes. Lots of questions and recurring themes. And I have a hunch that some of them crop up for you too.
Yeah, let's try. I have a lot of questions on note cards here. So we're just going to kind of go through them and see if we can fill in the blanks for some listeners.
Yeah, well, the first question I have here is, and this was one I was asked many times, was, is Insight live? And the answer is, well, it depends. Because it's often live.
But most sometimes, of the time it's
yeah,
live.
Yeah, most of the time it's live, but sometimes it's not, and sometimes portions of it are live and sometimes aren't. And the reason why it's sometimes recorded is that there are oftentimes very good reasons, like a guest isn't available during the live broadcast, or we're going to be trying something more ambitious and it just takes more production effort to put into it.
Next question, how do you get story ideas? Oh, we hear that one often. And story ideas come from so many sources. They might come from another news source. They might come from a pitch that comes in directly and now either to email, by Twitter, by text, by a press release. They come from conversations and things we know in the community.
Yeah, I used to say that I was never not the Insight host because I would just be walking down the street and I'd see something interesting and I go, oh, make a mental note of that, talking to someone and an idea comes over you. So that's just part of the life of the host of a show like this, is you're always looking for great ideas so that we can be surprising and relevant.
My variation on that is that hosting the show is a lifestyle because you're always representing the station. You're always representing the show. And anywhere you go, someone might start a conversation with you about it. And you know you have to be on.
And you're absolutely right about being a representative, because there were times when I wasn't feeling great or not looking great. And I would go to a shop and I knew that people oftentimes would recognize my voice, even if they didn't know who I was to look at. So I'd sometimes mumble so they didn't know who it was.
You know, Jeffrey, I spent 30 years in television before I came to radio. It has been such a high compliment and a surprise to sometimes be recognized only for my voice by people who don't know what I look like and didn't know the TV part. But listeners to the show are really loyal and they feel really connected by the slightest nuance that they hear in a voice.
Indeed, there's a more intimate connection with people on the radio or in podcasts if that's the medium you're in, because that's all you have. It's just the voice coming into your ear.
I just handed you another note card.
Yeah, that's a good one. How much time does it take to prepare for a show? Well, it takes a long time in the sense that you're always working on shows and maybe you're working on a segment that's only going to air 3 months in the future, or you're working on a segment that's going to air in 3 minutes' time. So it does vary a lot, but it's really basically a day-long effort for all the staff who work on Insight.
We script the show now, which when I started could be 3 to 4 hours a day just working on what the production script would look like.
It's a full-time job.
And then in addition, yeah, if you're reading a book, you're going to a play, you're going to a speech, checking out research online, again, back to the lifestyle. Okay, I have a question here. How many people work on Insight behind the scenes? Well, we kind of tackled that list, but the team has varied from sometimes only the host and two other support people to sometimes a number of interns.
Yeah, well, when it started, it was just me and Benjamin Jonas Keeling, who was the producer. It was just the two of us. We had no interns. There was no other staff. So it was really quite a grind, to be frank. And that was when we started looking to expand what it takes, the infrastructure for the show. That was when we hired Jen Picard initially as a part-time producer and then a full-time producer and adding interns. And that really expanded what the show could do, because not only did it take the burden off the host and the producer, but it also just brought more ideas into the program, because that's part of what you do when you're on the program. You're bringing in ideas and perspectives.
Jeffrey, I have one for you here. Did you talk to the guests before the show?
I did not.
I
tried my best not to. I mean, if I was the person booking them, obviously I had talked with them in advance. But when the show was on the air or just when it was coming up, I would try and avoid speaking to guests deliberately, not to be rude, although I think some people thought I was being rude or arrogant. But I just felt, and I read this, that some other people on broadcasting do the same thing. You want to try and make sure that your conversation is as spontaneous as possible with the people. And I felt like if I went and chatted to them 20 minutes before the show, they'd want to know, what am I going to ask them? And I'd tell them, and then they'd give their answers. And then when we came into the studio, they'd go, well, as I told you 10 minutes ago, Jeffrey,
that's true.
The dreaded.
Right.
So that was why I tried not to do it. Even when they were sitting in the studio across the table from me, it'd be a little embarrassing sometimes, because I would just try not to speak to them other than say hi. And then, boop, into the interview.
I have approached it a lot of times completely in the opposite way. I'll go talk to a guest in advance. Sometimes I will tell them the first question I'm going to ask them so that they're composed going in. If one of the producers says to me that somebody's nervous, I go sit down with them. If I know people. So it's such a personal style thing.
I'm sure that when someone is nervous, it probably makes a big difference for them to talk.
But it's well known that Terry Gross doesn't ever have her guests in the same studio with her.
That's
she doesn't
right.
even look at them or be in person, because she doesn't want the presence to affect her conversation.
And that's kind of worked out for her.
Yeah. I would say. You're listening to a special edition of Insight. Our show has turned 15. The birthday is July 19th. We're in the midst of a behind-the-scenes conversation about getting Insight on the air every day. I'm Beth Ruyak, and with me is Jeffrey Callison. Hey, Jeffrey, let's tackle this one. How do we choose the segments that will go into a show? Now, that was one thing when you had one topic, 1 hour shows. Now
yeah.
we commonly have done 3 or 4 in an hour, so we have much more landscape for topics.
Yes. So originally it was an hour long show with one topic. So then it really had to be a substantial enough topic to sustain itself for a whole hour. But then as time went by, we realized that not every topic really needed a whole hour. So that's why we'd add like a subsidiary topic at the end of the show, which would sometimes be a little bit offbeat. And it just sort of slowly evolved from there. And I know it was Jen Picard who used to use this analogy when I was working on the show. She said it was kind of like a newspaper, that the A segment would be the front page.
Right.
And then the B segment would be sort of more like analysis of the news, that kind of thing. And then as you get towards the end of the show, it's like the back page of the paper, the sports section, the lifestyle section. And so every day was sort of like a little snapshot of every part of the local world as we saw it. So we would look for topics that were newsy, would look for topics that were big picture policy type topics, maybe something that was human interest, and then something that was arts, entertainment related.
I'm going to add to that with a listener question. How far in advance do you know what guests will be on the show? And in our case, sometimes we book someone a couple months in advance. Often it might be that same week or even that morning.
Yes. I always remember one time when there was a wildfire. It's a sadly recurring story. When there was a wildfire, this was happening up in Tahoe about 2007 or so, and we started the segment, and we didn't really know everyone that was going to be on. And I remember being told, we've got someone else on who had some personal testimony of the wildfire. So I basically just had to be flat out honest and say, who are you?
And, on the air live.
And it was very powerful, because it was clearly something very dramatic unfolding. That makes for a kind of stressful hour for the host and the staff of the program. But I think keeping it mixed up like that sometimes is good too.
Jeffrey, we've had guests cancel within the hour when they were supposed to show up.
Yes.
We've also had guests, often city leaders or politicians, who know timing so well that if you tell them we're starting at 9:06, they walk in at 9:04:30 maybe.
Yeah.
And some of them you really have a lot of faith in, but you're still kind of counting those seconds along the way.
Yeah, those are pretty stressful times. But you know what? Somehow it always seems to work out.
It does. I'm going to read a question that I'm going to answer myself because this is funny and this is very honest. What do people say to you about insight in those random encounters, like the grocery store or the post office? People often, in the last year or two, have said to me, when Jeffrey Callison left, I didn't think there was anybody that could follow him.
Oh, wow. Come
I on. Didn't think insight would stay together. And then they will say to me, and it took a little while because your style was so different. You had such a different approach to the show. But we've really grown connected and grown close. And I always hold that, Jeffrey, as such a supreme compliment to you. And I appreciate that they feel that they can be so upfront with me about how unsure they were at the beginning.
Well, that's good because it shows that people who listen to the program feel a connection to you and they feel like they can trust you to say that, because it's not necessarily an easy thing to say. And, you know, it was a big transition for me to move on from Insight. I was happy to do what I do now, but I was always very confident that the show would do well and go on, and it wasn't my show anymore. So I was happy to say, good luck, Insight. And when you were hired, I thought, wow, that was a great hire.
Do you regret that you left?
I do not. But one person who I won't name, who's very influential at the station, said, you'll probably be back because everyone does. And I haven't yet, but
I don't
regret it.
You're sitting right across from me right now.
Yes, I am. Yeah, but you know, my life has taken so many strange turns up to this point that I'm happy with the change that I made, and I'm happy with how the show's doing.
Okay, a couple more questions. One about the books, how many books we have to read. Someone said to me they thought it was 60 to 70 books in a year.
Yes, it's an awful lot of books. And for me, it just wasn't practical to be reading them all because I'm always reading so much news and so on that I would have to become a very efficient reader,
right,
shall we say.
That does happen.
You do
we
have
get
to
faster.
Yes. And there were a couple of times when I chose a reading for an author and it was a book that I really hadn't read. But I developed this technique that usually the last page of the first chapter made for a compelling reading because you're not so far into the book that people know that you're giving away the plot, but it's usually a cliffhanger. So you become an efficient reader, shall we say.
Why didn't
and
you
listener.
Write me a letter and leave me that little tip like 7 years ago? I always felt such a sense of obligation. I do. I have such respect for an author who spent so much time writing the book.
Oh, yeah.
And it's part of the NPR expectation in doing a book conversation that you will read it. So I haven't let go yet as much as that.
Well, good for you.
Yeah.
Good for you. We probably didn't do quite as many authors then. And as I said, I did read as much as I could, but sometimes it just wasn't always possible.
One last question. Any unexpected thing that happened or a favorite memory, something to add into the mix here? Like the days when we had alpacas in the studio, or we took a break and thought we were going to have one banjo player come in, and I see five people and five banjos suddenly walking into the studio.
Yeah, there are a lot of crazy memories, but I think one that always comes to my mind, it makes me smile, was back in the early days of the show when we were really casting around, just trying anything really, just to see what would work and what wouldn't. And there was a woman who lives in the foothills, is a sheep herder, and she had been over in Ireland or Scotland for a sheep herding competition with her border collies. So we invited her to come here, and the garden that's at the back of the radio studios here at that time was just the grass. It was just like a little field. So we had the sheep. The woman brought her sheep out and the sheep dog, and she did a sheep herding demonstration on the radio. So we had to do some play-by-play so that people could tell what was happening. And we had the dogs on. So when I think back to that, I think, well, that's really not something that your typical show does. And I just thought it was really cool. Sheep herding on the radio.
We did the art of flower arranging on the show, and it worked.
Oh, of course.
One more listener question I'm going to throw in here, and that is about the evolving social media and the evolution of radio right now and what the impact has been on the program. I think the change has been so rapid, probably during my last 7 years, more so than your first seven.
Yeah, it is, no doubt. But when I was host of Insight, I did start posting on Twitter several times a day. I really hadn't done anything along those lines before, and I did it for a few years, and I really enjoyed it. It added another dimension to reach out to people who listen to Insight and to newsmakers. So I did enjoy that, but it was clear that that was going to become increasingly important. You definitely have much more robust podcast component to the program now. The show is broken down into its segments. You can listen more conveniently.
We have quite a staff. We have a digital team now. And you sometimes do. Social media is a place to reach people, reach guests that we might not have another direct way of finding. We are celebrating 15 years of Insight on CAP Radio. And now you know a little bit more about how we've done it.
In the next segment, we'll talk about some conversations that have been defining for us personally and for Insight.
You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio.
Happy birthday to you.
I went to a garden party to reminisce with my old friends.
This is Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak.
And I'm Insight's original host, Jeffrey Callison. This is an Insight birthday hour. Insight turns 15 this month, and we're reminiscing about the program.
Reminiscing a little bit. We each have moments that we know help define Insight, not only according to its mission statement, but in a way that truly connected us as people.
The first clip that I've chosen from when I was host, it's actually a two-parter, and it's one, a person who was a repeated guest on the program. We have many repeated guests on the programs, people that you build a relationship with.
Right.
This was unusual in the sense that Casey Robbins was quite young when she was first on the program. In fact, she first became engaged with the program as a listener because Casey was sitting in the back of her car with her parents, as so many people do get started listening to NPR, and she was listening to Insight. And we had on as a guest at that time a man from Liberia who happened to live, maybe still does, live in West Sacramento. And he had been hired by the Liberian government to work for the government of Liberia in a communications position. So he was on Insight, and I was interviewing him about conditions in Liberia. And Casey was listening and was moved by what she heard about the conditions for children in particular in Liberia.
I heard that they were in need of stuff to rebuild their country. And so that's when I contacted him. And he also sounded really enthusiastic about how his country was getting back on track and about how happy he was about that.
And how did you find him? Google?
Basically. I just typed in his name on Google and I got his phone number and position and everything.
And what did he say when you reached him?
He said they were in need of textbooks for their schools. Then I thought, because at my school, about every 4 years, they rotate out the textbooks. So I asked the coordinator at my school if they had extra textbooks that had been rotated out. And he said they had about 350 right there on campus. So that was great to find them so quickly.
Now, did you then get back to Gabriel Williams or someone else in Liberia and say, hey, would these books work?
Yeah, I then emailed Gabriel Williams, and he said anything was great for right now, and that would be great if I could get them to them.
But there is a bit of a problem, isn't there?
Yeah, shipping is really expensive to get all the way to Africa. My first quote that I got for shipping was $26,000.
What?
Which is a little more than we can do.
$26,000 to ship
a
few hundred books?
Yeah, because each textbook weighs about 5 pounds. So they weigh like 1,500 pounds total, which gets expensive.
Wow. That cost, though, didn't stop her, did it?
No, Casey. And that was in 2007 that she was speaking there. She went on to deliver that shipment, and she kept going. And eventually, she was invited to go to Liberia to meet Liberia's president.
She was surprisingly motherly. she was really nice about everything. She actually gave me some advice about how to continue in my life, about pursuing an engineering career, which I thought was really nice of her. And she was very warm. She was very welcoming. But at the same time, she definitely had the politician manner of getting her point across in as few words as possible.
In this press release that I got from the government of Liberia, it said that that on your trip, you visited public schools that are beneficiaries of the textbook program, and a school was renamed in your honor. How did that come about? And tell us about that school.
A couple years ago, I got an email from a professor from the University of Liberia who wanted to name a school after me. And I thought, okay, that's never going to happen. But this man wanted, I guess, to use me as an inspiration for their students. And now, when I went, I got to see the building, and it's supposed to start in September 2011, which is crazy because, I mean, in the U.S., we name schools after dead people.
It still thrills me to hear this after all this time because it was such an astonishing turn of events happened just from a girl sitting in the back of her parents' car, mm-hmm. listening to Insight, moved to take action, an extraordinary person, clearly, and she's obviously changed other people's lives. So to me, that was one of the definite standout memories for me of Insight when I was a host.
Mm, what a great story. But you had some extraordinary guests.
Yeah, there's another person who is definitely in the short list for me. Her name is Kim Fook, which might or might not be a familiar name to you, but I can guarantee you're familiar with her because she was the unwitting subject of one of the most famous and gut-wrenching photographs ever taken, the girl in Vietnam who's the victim of a napalm attack and she's running naked down the street towards the camera. Well, that was Kim Fook, and she survived. She lives now in Canada, and she was on a tour of the United States. And so she came to our studio, and it was a very moving experience talking with her and hearing her story. And she started from the point when she was just about to be attacked.
I was 9 years old, and I remember the day exactly what happened to me. We hiding in the temple with another soldiers and another villagers. And so we saw the color mark they dropped inside the temple area. So it is mean they dedicated the temple was going to be bombed. Mm. So the soldier, they call to the children. They ask them, go out. We have to move. If we don't, we will be killed. So they asked the children run out first. And I was one of them. And I remember I just ran the front of the temple. And I saw the airplane getting lower. And then I saw four bombs landing down. And suddenly I saw the fire everywhere around me. I didn't see anybody at that moment but fire. And I saw the fire over my body.
It was quite a remarkable experience. Listening to Kim talk and her courage and her grace was remarkable. And I could just feel the presence in the whole building because everyone stopped and was listening to her. So that, for obvious reasons, was another strong memory for me from my time in Insight.
This job and this program makes one grateful for the courage people have and the willingness to bring out so much of what is inside of them and not only tell another human being, but tell everybody in this public way on radio. And that's a perfect example of that. It's a privilege to host a conversation like that.
Absolutely. You're listening to the 15th birthday edition of Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison, back in the studio with Beth Ruyak.
One of the most profound conversations I had was in the fall of 2016. A lovely, graceful woman named Carol Yates had decided to end her life using a new California law that had just created a legal pathway to do so. Carol was 69. She had terminal cancer and Parkinson's disease. She was clearly a deep and soulful thinker. And here's part of our conversation.
The doctors only do what they really believe is the right thing for them as well as their patient. I've learned that there's a difference between the big picture and really dealing with how you want to die. It's big, scary stuff, but the question is not whether or not I'm dying. The question is how I want to die.
You know, if we in the business of taking care of the sick and dying believe that it is our primary directive to do no harm, we need to really look at what we believe death is. I think Carol would tell you, and I have heard this from countless patients, there are worse things than death.
Are there, Carol, worse things than death?
Yes, I think suffering is worse than death. Fear. Death is just part of us. It's part of our lives. And I think we don't look at it until we feel we have to, until we're pretty much forced to in general. I think fear and suffering are much, much worse.
How did you find Carol? And how did you approach her about doing this, talking with you on Insight about what she was going through?
You heard Ellen Robinson-Haynes in that clip. Originally, I wanted to interview Ellen because I knew that she was working with people making this decision, but I asked her to get Carol's permission to talk to me. So when she talked to Carol and Carol heard what we were doing, Carol said, I want to tell the story myself, which I thought was important. And in fact, Carol's husband, Bill, later talked with me as well. So this is, again, a situation where you feel privileged to listen and cautious about asking questions. And it's always a matter of respect in handling a person's story perfectly. And then I rely on the audience feedback to let me know if we did this. And in the way that this story was received, I felt that we had done something really powerful.
No question about that.
So we'll be rebroadcasting the End of Life show again soon and probably over a number of years. Thank you again to the Yates family.
Now, you also had some powerful conversations about Stephan Clark and what happened to him and what happened in Sacramento after his death. And some of those conversations were with Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg.
Stephan Clark was shot and killed in his grandmother's backyard in March of 2018. He had smashed windows and been chased by police to some extent in the South Sacramento neighborhood of Meadowview. That exposed and escalated racial tension and anger and pain across the region. There were explosive city council meetings, but such an unfolding of dialogue everywhere between all different kinds of people. There were remarkable conversations on Insight. But to the point about the mayor, here's one piece of a conversation that I heard people talk about often. I want to pause you there. A little later in the show, we're going to hear 10 different voices. And there were hundreds last night speaking to what you're talking about right now, which is a bigger, deeper wound, a social wound that's in the city.
Beth, I've had a 22-year public service career where I have consistently devoted myself to issues of inequality and poverty. I haven't been waiting even before this horrible situation occurred. We've launched the single largest workforce development program for high school students in the city, 1,000 strong. We are aggressively addressing
Mr.
the
Mayor,
homeless and housing problem.
My time, I'm just going to pause you because my time with you is precious, and it's important today that we stay very close to individuals and to people. So that said, tell me more about what you heard from people last night about their everyday, very real lives and what's going wrong.
It's not that different from what I hear and what I respond to every day, with the exception of it being coupled with this incredible grief and trauma around the death of Stephan Clark. None of this is new to me. And by the way, none of the urgency that you hear from me is any different from the urgency you've heard from me every time I've been on your radio show talking about similar issues. It's just that the context now is different, and the emotion is even more raw than it usually is.
In conversations, the first step is to have someone say yes. right? Mm-hmm. Because there are plenty of people that will say no or no comment or I don't want to talk. But when anybody is willing to say yes, then you can begin the dance. Then there are possibilities. In that case, major violent demonstrations had been avoided in the city, I think, because a lot of work that was done by a lot of people. As many of you might know, the DA did not file charges. The family did sue the city, and we are still awaiting results of the Sacramento Police Department's internal investigation.
When we come back, a bit about transitions on Insight. In December of 2011, I stepped down as host. A few months later, Beth was named the new host.
And throughout those 15 years, the show itself has continued to change and grow. We'll talk a bit more about that and where the show is headed when we come back. This is Insight on Capital Public Radio. This is Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak.
And I'm Insight's original host, Jeffrey Callison. We're wrapping up this hour-long birthday celebration. And there's more on the website, capradio.org/insight.
One more time. It's really great to have you in the studio. Isn't this fun?
It is. I'm so happy to be here.
I think I need you to come back more often. Not as a guest host, as a co-host. 15 years of Insight behind us. As you might have heard, Cap Radio is looking to the future with some exciting plans. Have you heard this, Jeffrey?
Yes, I have heard it and read about how you're moving to a new building. It seems like it wasn't that long ago that we moved into this one.
Yeah, if it all goes as planned, Cap Radio will move from this home on the Sacramento State campus to a building in downtown Sacramento on J Street with... Are you ready for this? A street side studio.
Meaning you'll have an audience poking their noses up against the glass?
Meaning the glass right there. This will be an audience in motion. People walking by or riding a jump bike, pausing to listen for a little bit and then moving on through their day.
That sounds kind of intriguing because here in this studio, it's a bit of a bunker, actually. You don't see the outside world. It'll be nice to see the sky.
It is a little sterile here at times, and I think getting some of that immediate reaction and the faces, it can be really energizing when you're in the studio. As far as a timetable, maybe 2-3 years, but wherever the show is, the essence of Insight, I think, is going to be the same. And Jeffrey, I was convinced of this when I heard the end of your final show as host. You made some comments, and I'd like to replay them now, but this is from December of 2011.
There'll be a search for a permanent host, but in the meantime, Insight will continue on the air. I really hope that people will continue to listen to Insight, and I hope that it remains the strong program that it's become, because there isn't a lot like Insight on the air in Sacramento, or pretty much anywhere, it's sad to say. And I'm really proud of the fact that it's developed into a program where a civilized place where people can talk about things that need to be talked about in a way that that doesn't happen so much elsewhere. Mm. Wow. Well, that's still true today. It just seems like a very short time ago when I said that. And I still listen to Insight. I'm still so happy that the show's doing as well in such good hands as yours, Beth. And to hear that the program has grown and is continuing to grow is really exciting. I mean, it grew a lot when I was a host, and it's grown a lot since then, and there are big plans for the future.
Well, thank you for your kind words. You spoke to that town square kind of place that Insight holds in the community, especially as newspapers change and the challenges people have in figuring out what a real news source is. You articulated beautifully then what Insight continues to try to be every day now.
Yes. You know, I said that there wasn't a lot like it around at that time, and I think it's still true today. The reality is it's very expensive to make a program like this. Not like it costs millions of dollars, mm-hmm. but it's still, for an organization the size of Cap Radio, it's a big investment to do this. So it's something that it's easy for organizations to go, let's not bother. Because you know what? You could just go to the network all the time and play those great shows from NPR. But it's important. It's really important to have programs like Insight so that a community can hear itself through its guests. And whether those are extremely powerful, influential politicians like Mayor Steinberg, or whether it's an 11-year-old girl like Casey Robbins sitting in the back of a car everyone in between, they all have a place and insight, and you don't really have a chance to hear those kinds of in-depth conversations, other than perhaps little sound bites, anywhere else.
Resources that come into a public radio station can be put in so many different places where they're useful and needed. And I think there's a more acute understanding than ever before that a show like Insight needs resources to continue to be strong and grow strong. That said, I do want to send out a cheer and a nod and a thank you to everybody who gave their blood, sweat, and tears, their time, and their energy when the resources were skinny to keep making this show strong, to make it a passion project and stay very dedicated to it. It's been my honor, I'll say, to be able to host. And I really love that the audience is dedicated. And so the show's going to be there. You'll be there. So let's just keep going for another 15.
So, I guess happy 15th birthday to Insight and many more. I'm Jeffrey Callison.
And I'm Beth Ruyak. This birthday special was produced by both of us, along with Mark Jones.
Thanks to the digital team, Chris Hagen, Casey Gardner, and Emily Zentner.
Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. And Jeffrey, thank you again for being here and for all of what you began 15 years ago.
It was a total pleasure and a total honor. Thank you.
Happy birthday to Insight.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.